Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Yesterday, I was here in the SiriusXM studios with one Rob Thomas. We were talking about his new album, Chiptooth Smile, and a whole lot more. Let's get right to that interview. Hello, Rob Thomas.
Hello. When you say 50 years of great journalism, and now we have this, does that mean it's what we've devolved to, or is this a continuation of 50 years of great journalism?
Well, you know, Rob is referring to a little tagline that if you're listening to the podcast, you usually don't get to hear. It's only on the radio version. I wrote that. It's like, take it how you will. It's meant to be maybe a little funny.
We're deciding our future right now as we go.
That's right. It could go either way.
Yeah, I'm a little scared right now.
That's the thing, man. Before we started, you were talking about all the famous women that before you got married, you possibly could have hooked up
with.
But didn't. But
now, we're not going to name those names on
Names, but
wait a minute. That wasn't like, I didn't just walk in the room and just start.
That's true.
So there was a conversation that led up. I just don't want people to think that I'm the kind of guy that just walks in the room and goes, by the way, you knew who I never banged.
No. But it was pretty funny though. But we're in a more serious mode now, so we're not going to fully go there.
I have no time for frivolity. I'm a very important person. I got stuff to do. Very serious stuff to do. Music serious.
But there was a time. There was a time before your marriage when life was freer, I guess.
Yeah, I think you have to do that. I've been married for over 20 years now because I had that time. I never had that wonder, like, oh, what if, you know. I went out and had a really fun time. I got some, you're a young kid, you get the keys to the city, you get to go have some fun, and I went and did it until I realized that it just wasn't a lot of fun anymore, and then it was perfect timing.
You have a new album coming out at the end of April called Chiptooth Smile. I got a chance to listen to it and really enjoy it.
Thank you.
There's no one doing the kind of thing you're doing on this album, which is just kind of straight ahead. It's a little more pop rock than I'd say some of your solo albums, mm-hmm. which have often been more kind of slightly funkier R&B leaning, but it just feels a real nice gap. And I can feel Butch Walker seems like a great producer for you.
He's awesome. You know, what's funny is I kind of just manifest destiny that one. Like, I didn't let Butch know that I was going to, like, I was telling everybody for like a year. They're like, so what's your next thing? I was like, oh, I think I'm going to make a record with Butch Walker. I was just telling everybody. And then eventually I got around to telling Butch, and luckily he was down with it. You know, like, I had a really good run with Matt Cerletic, with Matchbox and Solo and the stuff with Willie Nelson and the Carlos Santana. But it was just kind of time, I think, to get a little new blood to kind of infuse someone that hears me differently.
Yeah.
And Butch has always been a really good friend. He's also an amazing singer-songwriter himself, so you're looking through that prism as opposed to just a producer's prism. And he plays pretty much every instrument on this record. There's like a couple a couple drum tracks that he doesn't, and a couple piano tracks and guitar, but almost, you know, 99% of this record is all me and Butch Walker. That's it.
Nice.
Yeah.
And the first single is One Less Day, Dying Young, and we can actually hear a little bit of that right now.
From dying young, I see my life like a train on a one-way track. I've made mistakes.
So it has a few things going on. There's a little bit of a Celtic thing towards the end. What it reminded me a little bit of, and as I was saying, I just wrote a book about Bruce Springsteen, a little plug of my own there, but I have a lot of Bruce Springsteen on my mind, but it had a little bit of a Wrecking Ball feel to it in there.
Yeah, I could hear that. I think we were thinking more like there's a little bit of 80s themes that run through everything on this record, like sonically.
For sure.
So I think Big Country was definitely in that mind of like of that kind of Celtic thing, but wrapped up in that pop rock kind of a vibe, you know?
Well, the 80s thing, there's a couple full-on nods to Phil Collins, I think.
Yes.
One is a song called Timeless that nods to, I wouldn't say every 80s song ever written, but just about.
I think there's like 17 or 20 of them in there. I describe that song as it's an 80s song about listening to 80s songs, and almost every lyric is from an 80s song or an 80s song title. So it's more like a scavenger hunt to go through and try and figure out like where all the songs line up. But then at the end, we just blatantly played the Phil Collins.
Which
is funny because in any other situation, you can't copyright a drum fill. Like, that's just not a thing. You know, it's not a lyric or a melody. But that one is so famous that we just reached out and got permission just in case.
The vibe at the beginning, now this is an artist that a little hard to mention at the moment, but the vibe at the beginning does remind me of a song called Human Nature by Michael Jackson. I don't know if that was
We were actually thinking more like Time After Time, Cyndi Lauper.
Okay, well, same kind of thing. Okay,
I'm gonna stick with that one now.
Cyndi's behavior has been exemplary. So.
As of right now, she still kept that shit together. So thank you, Cyndi.
So let's stick
with
that one.
Not messing it up. I'm calling all my idols right now, by the way, and just calling them up and going, don't. Whatever you're thinking of doing, just stop.
You know, I'm terrible with song titles with the albums I've just started listening to, but is it Early in the Morning that also has that little bit at the beginning that's also an In the Air Tonight kind of vibe?
Totally.
Thing.
And that, you know, it's funny because when I wrote Early in the Morning, it was a guitar-driven song. Like, I wrote it on acoustic and sent it to Butch. And Butch gave it back to me with those two flavors. One was that little kind of 808 drum sound at the beginning. Rain, and then that vocal effect, which I don't think I've heard since In the Air Tonight. Like, it's so unapologetically Phil Collins that you had to listen to the song twice, because the first time you hear it, you think that I'm ripping off In the Air Tonight, but the truth is, I'm just so stylistically ripping it off. Like, the lyric and the melody are completely different, but like, that vibe is so that same kind of a vibe, you know, those washy guitars, the kind of ethereal sounds, you know, more like just kind of a nuanced sounds as opposed to like actual parts. Yeah, no, I loved what Butch did with that, man. Because him and I were both children of the 80s, and we grew up on 80s radio specifically.
Yeah.
So not like the cool 80s as much, but like the 80s, you know,
the actual 80s that most people experience.
Yeah, like Foreigner. Like, we got some stuff on here that's got Foreigner pads, you know, and we're talking Don Henley, but not Boys of Summer. It's more like Last Worthless Evening Don Henley, you know, kind of period.
It's funny because you have 80s nostalgia, as do we all, but there's a lot of 90s nostalgia as well. You feel your own nostalgia for your younger days while people are feeling nostalgia for the days when you started making music.
Yeah, you know, on that, so the day that my single was released, I got a new single's coming out, and I got a call. They had just put 3 a.m. into classic rock rotation.
Whoa. I must be lonely, huh?
And I thought, man, that is like, that's the dream right there. Like, if you're putting your song in classic rock, which you've been, you know, around long enough for that to happen, but then on top of it, you've got something new coming out.
That's wild. So is there an official classic rock registry? Like, how does that work? Like,
No, it's just, you know, our classic rock station had officially put it into their rotation.
Got it. So someone became the first to declare that classic rock, basically. Yeah. That is wild. That's a weird feel. But the best feeling is that you're
Smooth is 20 years old now.
Oh, yeah. We're getting to that, man. Don't worry. Yeah.
So, like, that's a whole animal right there. Like, if you think about, you know, I think Matchbox is now on 22 or 23.
Yeah.
Jeez.
It's wild. So you're 47, right?
Mm-hmm. 47.
Looking good.
Thank you, sir.
Did you expect to, A, because you lived pretty wild when you were young, did you expect to, A, kind of live to 47 and be healthy and well and active, and B, still be actively making music on the level you still are at this age?
No, I think when I was really young and just starting out, I think somehow I simultaneously felt like I was going to live forever and I wasn't going to make it past 25. Because both of those sounded horribly romantic, right? You know, you wanted to either be James Dean, live fast, die young, or you just had this sense of, you know, that somehow you weren't like everybody else. Everybody else is getting older, but not you. You know, you're just going to stay this beautiful young version of yourself forever and ever and ever. And then the first time your knees crack, you're like, oh shit, no, that's not me. I'm not that guy.
When you were, I don't even want to say partying, because I think it went beyond that. When you were really like not treating yourself well as a really young person, you were kind of leaning towards the die at 25.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a whole lot. I think this job and this world had got me over a bridge and gave me so much, and you know, but it also got me to the point where I could have a son, and got me to the point where I could have a marriage, and got me to the point where, you know, I think when you're young and you're writing songs, you're writing all these songs about love and loss, and the truth is, a lot of it is speculation, you know, because you're really, really young, you haven't really loved or lost anything in the way that you're talking about it. You're just kind of being informed by other songs that you've listened to, or movies or books, you know. But then as you get older, you actually do find something that you're scared to lose, and those things start to mean more to you. Those themes become more real. And so I think you stop looking for ways to manufacture these emotions and feelings, and you just start naturally having them on your own. And so then you maybe don't need the psychedelics as much.
Are there early songs that sound different to you now or mean more to you now of your own?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, every record you make, I think when you listen to it, the best you can hope for is it's the best possible record you could have made at that time. So that means that if I've gotten any better over the last 20 years, when I listen to the first record, it's easy to hear, not the mistakes, but the limitations. It's easy to listen to that as a piece of time capsule and listen to the recording of it, and listen to how your voice sounded then, and listen to the mix, but not so much. I can listen to those now when I play them live, and I still connect with those songs as a song.
Right.
But when I hear the recordings of them, I don't feel connected to them at all. It doesn't sound like me. So like, to the point where like people are like, oh my God, that first record's my favorite. And I'm like, really? Like, you should come hear me live. I'm not sure. Are you really? Have you heard this?
I mean, this all connects obviously to One Less Day Dying Young, because it is like sort of, I don't want to say it's a middle-aged song, because none of us want to think of ourselves as middle-aged, but it has a recognition of aging as something that's not bad. I really like the idea of it. Every day that you're living is one more day away from dying young.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of songs about being young forever and never growing old. And when you think about what you're saying, pardon me, it's a bleak alternative to not growing old. And I've lost some friends over the last few years, and people really, really close to me, and they're not going to get that opportunity to get older. And I think you realize that getting older is a privilege, and it's not afforded to everyone. And when you start realizing that and thinking that way, you stop the "you only live once" mentality, and you start to think like, well, you only die once, and you live every day you can right up until that point.
Well, LCD Sound System had a song a couple years ago that just like, kind of goofing on the idea that every song on the radio is like, tonight is the only night we have. We're going to die tonight. We're going to die young. Like, this is another kind of, it's a response to that.
Once you get like past your mid-30s, you're heading into your 40s, then you start writing songs about like, okay, maybe not tonight. Maybe next weekend. I could pencil you in by Tuesday, but I'm not really sure. I got a thing.
We can die young next week, but tonight I gotta go to sleep. Yeah. And then We Were Beautiful is another sort of nostalgic song. I don't know how autobiographical that is or where that's coming from exactly.
Yeah, you know, it literally came from my wife. We have a photograph that's in our kitchen, in our home. And it's me and my wife and our friend Dayon. We were like in Australia probably like 12 or 15 years ago. And my wife said, she's like, oh, we were beautiful when we were young. And I realized that she wasn't speaking about aesthetics. You know what I mean? She was thinking about the promise of youth. She was thinking about like all the stuff that we had ahead of us in there. And you kind of could see it in that picture and in those smiles. And that just kind of struck me as a very sad, beautiful thought.
Totally.
It's not about these younger bodies. It's not about the physical, but it is just about all that promise you have when you're young. That song, by the way, is the only song I didn't do with Butch Walker.
Huh.
I did that with Benny Blanco.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. I was going to ask you about everyone I've talked to who work with Butch, the guys in Fall Out Boy, etc. Like, he's one of those guys with just a tremendous amount of craft.
Oh.
Songwriting craft, musicianship, production. So what did you learn from, especially having been, you know, worked with the same guy for so long? Like, what did you take away from that?
Well, I love the fact that he's not very precious about things. He believes, like, you set it up, and if the song's good and we've got the bones of where we want to go, then he just does it all by feel, as opposed to, like, he doesn't really sit down and sweat the minutiae. He doesn't go through the small stuff. You know, he's not worried about, you know, the vocal having to be this pristine. He'd rather get a good vibe out of something than something that's just kind of perfect. And I think there's no right or wrong way to do it, but, you know, Matt Cerletti came from a world where it was these very polished records.
Yeah.
They sounded very, very polished, and everything was tuned down, and it had its very own aesthetic, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just a certain kind of aesthetic, whereas Butch is a very much more kind of carefree, haphazard way of, let's throw the mic on it, let's get it down, you know, and let's try. And that's why I think usually if you hear a record and all the instruments are played by one guy, it doesn't sound like a band in the room. It's missing some sort of vitality. But for some reason, when he does it, it sounds like you can hear the band sitting there playing it.
That's interesting. I mean, it's weird because you did have Matt for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And what was it about just kind of moving towards less of an R&B thing? This, as a soul album, it starts to blur the line maybe between a soul album and a Matchbox sounding record, maybe more than your other soul album.
Yeah, maybe. You know, I think Butch could have a lot to do with that as well. I'm writing all the time. And so by the time a record time comes around, I've got 4 records worth of different stuff. And a lot of that, once you sit down with the producer, you and the producer kind of figure out, he helps you pick through like what he's excited about. And so I think maybe some of these vibes kind of excited him a little more. Maybe, you know, I was writing a lot of these while I was on the road with Matchbox as opposed to being in solo world. I don't know anybody that only listens to one kind of music, you know, like, and so I always want to set out to try and make what you do be as diverse as the music that you listen to.
You've never met Eddie Trunk, who has a show on Sirius?
No. Because
there's a guy who listens to one kind of music.
Just one kind of music?
With all due respect, Eddie. Yeah. Proudly listens to one kind of music.
What, is it one band?
Hard rock.
Oh, I do. Yeah, that's true, though. That's a lifestyle of its own. I do know a lot of people like that.
But yeah, other than that, I know what you're saying.
I do listen to all that kind of music, and I think I've embraced the idea of pop rock. Like, I love the idea of pop rock. I think it's a giant world that's out there that kind of touches into a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And so, you know, I liked being able to do that. I think everything on this feels a little more rock and a little more organic pop, you know, and then except maybe Timeless would be the closest one that sounds kind of like tracky.
Exactly.
You know, but even that, it's all organic instruments. It's just got a tracky vibe to it.
I wanted to ask about context, because you're making an album in 2018, 2019, and everything that's a hit on streaming is Migos or Bad Bunny or stuff that's pretty far afield from anything you would do or would want to do without being like ridiculous.
Yeah, it would be like a bad suit.
So do you just sort of stop thinking about the super current stuff? How do you kind of keep the context of what you're working on in your mind?
You know, I think my last solo record, The Great Unknown, was I think the closest I ever came. It was more of an experiment than anything else. Like, the way that I've always done records is I go, I write a bunch of songs, I make a record, and then I bring it to my label and I say, here's my record. And didn't want to just go back to the same well, and I wanted to try something different. So me and Atlantic, we got together and we would work with different producers and get tracks, and I would write to their tracks, and I would work with people like Ricky Reed and Wallpaper and Ryan Tedder. And it was a fun experiment, But at the end, it didn't feel like me. You know what I mean? It kind of felt like me doing something else, or me doing a cover song or something. And so it was important for me to just kind of go back to, these are songs that I can sit down and I wrote at the guitar, I wrote at the piano, these are songs about my life. And I realized that that makes me a lot happier. And in truth, I can't do those other things. Like, if I tried my best, it's still going to sound like me. And it's going to sound like, in the middle of the worst case scenario, it won't sound like me, and it won't sound like the thing I'm trying to achieve, and I'll just be floating in no man's land.
Right.
So the best thing I can do is hope that I was lucky enough to have 20 years of people that are initiated, that are kind of might want to come down this journey with me, and they're waiting to see what I have to do. And to some degree, anybody that likes me, what you're saying is that you want my point of view. Like, right. You know what I mean? Like, you want my POV on things. And so me trying to do something like that to fit what's popular wouldn't be my point of view. And so maybe my job is to keep doing this the way that I do it until nobody cares about it anymore, and then stop. Like, if music doesn't work out for me, I'm not going to go on Dancing with the Stars. Mm. You know, like, I'm not trying to find another way to get my face in front of people. I'm just really, really happy if I'm a successful musician. That does matter to me, because I like that if I'm putting out music and people like it and they like what I'm doing and they want to go on that journey and come see me live, that does mean something to me. But then everything else about it, not so much. So I realized that it's really just about, I'm not going to be this, I'm not going to be cutting edge, I'm not going to be that. I just need to try and write good songs.
We are going to talk briefly about the beverage that Rob is just lightly sipping from. Could you tell us about this beverage?
Very, very lightly sipping. As I was walking into the beautiful Sirius building, I ran into a buddy of mine who is one of the editors at High Time Magazine. By the way, his name is Danny Danko, and he has a new book called Cannabis, A Beginner's Guide to Growing Marijuana, coming out. I want to give him a plug.
Absolutely.
And he gave me I've never even seen like an edible tea. It's like an Arnold Palmer edible.
Yeah, it's a little bottle that has 50 milligrams of THC, and we were saying, if I don't know about your tolerance, but if
anybody's tolerance, if I drank that whole thing,
you'd be on Venus.
Yeah, I'd be Looney Tunes right now.
Yeah. I mean, that would be one of the most memorable interviews of all time. So you have something to do afterwards.
Yeah, don't you worry. That cap's staying on now for the rest of the day. I had to taste it though.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's scary because apparently it tastes good. So it's
so good.
That's the worst. You're showing remarkable forbearance. Let the record show. It's just sitting right there.
It's just gonna sit there. It's gonna stay right there. Sheila, keep your hands off.
All good. For a while, you quit marijuana altogether, I think, right?
It wasn't a purposeful thing. You know, I had started getting some weird panic attacks and freaking out, and I just needed to take a little break from it. I think it was my body's way of just saying, you know, just to see if you can.
Do you find yourself writing high? Is that a big thing for you?
Yeah. That's what actually kind of got me back to it. I didn't really need it as much for like recreation, but when I started to hit dead ends, and if I smoke a little bit, it really kind of just frees up your mind for where the next place you want to go is going to be.
It's a time-honored technique.
It really is. Yeah, I don't think I'm the first one to think of this.
Chris Martin from Coldplay was the first person who ever told me he took, a sleeping pill, the most famous one. I can't remember.
Ambien?
Ambien. He would take Ambien and then not go to sleep and write songs.
Oh, that's crazy. My mother-in-law would take Ambien and then she would stay up, and it made her a compulsive shopper online.
Wow. It's either buying a bunch of shoes or writing Coldplay songs.
It's kind of crazy. Yeah. I think she got the short end of that stick, but I got a fucking awesome camo hoodie out of the deal. So, you know, I'm winning. Thanks, Mom.
Not from Chris Martin.
That would be a whole different story. Thank you, Chris. I met Chris once with my dog. I was in a bar in Toronto, and it was me and my wife and our dog kind of just sitting there. And he came over to the table because he said that he'd always wanted to meet me to tell me that when they first came to America, they were doing radio tours. And I guess I was doing radio. I was always in the stations right before them.
Right.
And every time they would come to a station, they would say that I was just in there and I was talking about this new band called Coldplay and my new favorite song, Yellow, and how great it was. And that he always wanted to thank me for that. And I thought that was a class act thing to do.
He's a good dude.
Right?
So I talked about the idea of like whether you expected to be kind of alive at this stage, but you didn't talk about, did you think that your music career would last to this point? Were you always kind of thinking about the long haul?
I think that I did, but out of pure ignorance. Like, I don't think that I really thought about what that would mean and entail. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're lucky enough to make it in the music business, it's because you had this suspension of disbelief and this will for ignorance of the odds. And that you literally, for some reason, thought, yes, of course I should make it. Why shouldn't I make it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you let that carry you until you lucked into a record deal. And then if you lucked into, you know, finding some success and you go out and you play. But I really thought that, of course we were going to make it and we were going to be big until we got signed. And then we started playing these shows with these really good bands. You know, like the first time we pulled up and we were playing, like, it was us, Dave Matthews, Smashing Pumpkins, and the Rolling Stones. And I'm just like, well, shit, these guys are good. Oh my God. You know, and that's when we started realizing that we needed to really work. And then by the second record, we became a really good live band, which when you think about the state of music, which is actually pretty strong, but the music business, maybe not so much. And they're, you know, it's still a kind of figuring out what that means, the paradigm of the music business. but you realize that the good thing about it was like, we were one of the last bands that kind of in the last traditional way that you made record. You had a guy from a label would come to your town and he would listen to your band. And if he liked you, he would sign you, and then you would make a record and you would get songs on the radio. And if enough people liked it, they would come see you live, and then you would sell records, and that's the career, you know?
Right.
And that's how it works. And if you didn't succeed right away, you might have a little more time to actually become a really good band.
Right. People might not know that there was drama and controversy in the very beginning of your career. I guess like Matt, longtime producer, he heard you in your band Tabitha's Secret. And it was one of those things. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like it's one of those things, classic thing, like a producer's like, the singer's the guy.
Kind of the thing, but we were, as a band, Tabitha's Secret, we were imploding. And literally just in the middle of these fights all the time. And I also didn't know anything about the music business. So I had a guy that would have all these songs that I wrote, and he would just bring in these copyright papers and say, here, we're all going to sign these. And so everybody got in on the copyright of these songs. And then, so when the band broke up, Matt came to me, and he actually, Atlantic Records offered to sign me, just me alone. And I said that I would do it if I could bring Paul and Brian from the band. Paul, who was our drummer, and now he's our guitar player, and our bass player, Brian. And they said that was fine. I could bring them as long as it was I was going to be writing the songs. And we did that. But then I was so upset with the other guys that were in this band that all the songs, with the exception of 3 a.m., I threw out every other song that we had written up until that point, and in 6 weeks or so, wrote the first Matchbox record. I was like living at my girlfriend's parents' house, and I would just sit in the room all day long and just write and write and write. And so I got that record just because out of spite,
right?
You know, but I felt
spite and breakups, the two fuels for albums. Yeah.
So I had the greatest thing, because you know that your biggest fear is that you have your entire life to write your first record, and then it's in between you got to go write another record, and it never really seems to work out that way. But I wrote my second record as my first record.
I never thought about it that way.
And so I felt like going into the second record, I was like, well, I got this now, you know.
The crazy thing is that there is a version of 3AM, of course, by Tabitha's Secret. Yep. Which, if I remember correctly, there was a thing where some radio stations were playing that version. It was
They were, because when we were like just starting out, it was happening a lot more back then at terrestrial radio, but where you'd have local band nights, you know, like an hour or two of just like local music from all over your scene or from different scenes. And so 3AM was already getting like play in those kind of independent stations. And then there were some places that are just, they're such like weird, like purist dicks about things that they're just like, it's not as good as the original, you know? And that band was not a good band. Like Matchbox 20 wasn't a really good band when we started. I think, you know, we were good in the studio. We had some good instincts and we had good songs, but it wasn't until the end of that cycle of like touring around the world.
Right.
That we were like a come see us, we were a good fucking band.
You had to
band.
Get some road testing.
Yeah, man. Yeah. I mean, and we were, and even then, I mean, when we started before we got signed, we were a van and trailer, at least, you know, through up and down the Southeast, kind of playing nonstop band for anybody. But it's just not the same as going out there and cutting your teeth in front of a large group of people who don't care that you're there.
When you were writing something like Push, because we were talking about context, when you hear that song, we can hear it for a second. She said, I don't know if I've ever been good enough. I'm a little bit rusty. I think very much of the 90s alt-rock radio at the time.
Sure.
It fits so well in that format. So it's sort of like, I could say this for a bunch of the really good songs from that era, it seems like everyone had sort of Nirvana and a bunch of stuff in their head and were writing in that vein. Is that the case to a certain extent?
I think that we were definitely manufacturing some angst, you know, that maybe was some other emotion just misguided and wrapped up into angst. I think we were
maybe we're talking about the guys in Tabitha's Secret.
I think we were a little more informed by, like, we were coming off of the Counting Crows and Toad the Wet Sprockets of the worlds as much as, because we obviously weren't heavy enough to be, even though we were giant fans of like Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and because I grew up on Ministry, you know what I mean, and Night Sereb and like just all kinds of music out there. But I think we were more definitely leaning on the singer-songwriter side of things. And what was funny is when that first record, and it was the only time I feel like me or Matchbox, what we did was what was happening at the time, and we needed that to kind of get us into that jump.
Sure.
Because then every other time we've had any success, it didn't really sound like everything else that it was sitting amongst, you know, like we had Unwell out, and it's a song with a banjo, and then everything around us was like Ludacris and Nelly, you know, like it was that late 90s early 2000 hip hop kind of boom that was happening, southern hip hop, you know.
I remember being at, actually I think it was at my college paper, and I got the first Matchbox 20 bio, and it said you had been homeless for a little while, which is true. Mm-hmm. Right. But I remember our reaction was like, oh Christ, Jewel was homeless on the same level. Like, everyone's got to be homeless now. Come on, this is bullshit.
It's a total thing. It's funny, I didn't do a whole lot of talking about it, I think, because I never wanted to compare my situation to a situation that is desperate as families that are actually homeless and living on the street. I had an untenable situation at home and I chose to leave and hitchhike around the country. But for me, I was 17, 18 years old. I've got a fucking copy of The Subterraneans in my back pocket. You know, I think I'm Sal Paradise running around the world. And like, there was a romanticism to it that was just better than my situation at home. You know, my mom was drinking a lot. She was a very young mom. We would be at odds a lot. And I think every day, like, had I not done that, if I just had a supportive, loving, caring environment and just went to Little League every day and, you know, got a nice job somewhere and had a, that would have sucked for me.
Yeah.
You know, like everything kind of worked itself out. And everything from the gypsy lifestyle to the just kind of like ingenuity that you wind up learning, like how to kind of survive on a daily basis and how to kind of roll with the punches that life gives you. I think those things came in really, really handy in this job.
Let's talk about Smooth for a minute.
Let's talk about Smooth.
You've done a bunch of interviews today. You probably already talked about Smooth, and we've talked about Smooth in the past, but it has such a life to it. 20 years later, it's like a meme. It's a whole thing.
It is its own complete universe at some point. And I took the same journey that everybody else in the world took with it. Like, I was like, oh, this is a catchy song. This is a good summer jam. Hot Latin girls want to dance to it. I'm down. And then we kind of moved into like, God, if I hear this song again, I'm going to shoot myself right in the face with a Latin gun. And then 15 years after that, I'm just kind of like, yeah, you know, sometimes it holds up. Like, I feel like with Smooth, like, I'm okay if I never hear Smooth.
Uh-huh.
But I love playing it.
Mm.
When we play it, it's fun every night. Like, it's a jam. And when I do it with Carlos, even more so. But I'm okay with not hearing it again.
How often do you get a chance to talk to Carlos?
We talk pretty on the reg.
You know what? Carlos once told us that if he wants someone to call him, he doesn't have to text him or anything. He can just send out a psychic signal and that they'll call.
That feels about right.
Have you ever gotten one from him? Like a psychic?
Maybe. Maybe that's why whenever I reach out, because every time I reach out, he's like, I was just thinking about you.
See? Oh, there you go. A few more sips of that, you're going to get a
No, sometimes, a like, signal, sometimes yeah. like we'll both just be in tune because I'll be somewhere drinking and he'll be somewhere drinking and we'll just get on the phone and start talking. You know, we're always texting each other. I'm surprised, and this isn't like talking out of school.
No.
I am surprised at Carlos's liberal use of emojis. Like, it's a very surprising thing that a guy like Carlos, it just loves the emojis and like gifs of babies dancing and shit. Like, you know, the greatest thing that happened out of that whole thing was the relationship that I got from him. And I think meeting him when I did, right at the end of, you know, the end of that record, we had all that success and it was 3 years on the road. But then all of a sudden, it's like the bus drops you off after 3 years and I'm in the middle of Manhattan and I have no idea how the me after this relates to the real world. Like, I've only existed within the frame of being on the road and, you know.
Yeah.
And I meet Carlos, who kind of at a very meaningful time taught me the difference between being a celebrity and being a famous musician.
Yeah.
And that being a famous musician is something that we always, as kids, we wanted. We wanted people to like our music. We wanted people to come see us play music. But if it's not attached to your motive and your intention and your purpose, it doesn't mean anything at all. And so he kind of taught me that at a really, really good time.
So it's his fault that you didn't hook up with all those famous women.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, no. I think even he would have been like, okay, come on, Rob.
Now, so, I mean, it was a co-write with, like, Ital Shore, right?
Yeah.
And so who wrote the line? Everyone quotes, man, it's a hot one. Who wrote the
lyrics? That was me. I wrote all the lyrics. And then Ital had a track that was very close to the under track of Smooth with a different melody and a different lyric. And I wrote everything up to the chorus. And then I thought the chorus actually was the pre-chorus. This life ain't good enough. You know, mm-hmm. I thought that was the chorus. And we just, like, it needed another lift. And so me and Ital got together, figured out the next melody for that. I was living in Soho at the time, so I was just kind of sitting around in the summer of Soho with my hot Latin wife, just kind of, you know, like, and so the song was kind of easy for that, you know.
Yeah, it was hot summer. Was it probably a hot day when you sat and wrote the Not Left?
Yeah, I'm sure it was, yeah. I would give up every dime in royalties that I've made for Smooth if instead I could get a nickel for every time somebody goes, man, it's a hot one. If you ever get a chance, and this is to anyone listening, this is where Smooth culminates and comes to a head. Me and Matchbox did a bit for Funny or Die.
Mm, yeah.
If you type into Matchbox 20 Smooth, Funny or Die, and it's us doing, basically, it's like a Jerry Bruckheimer CSI kind of crime show, completely based on just the song Smooth. And it's so ridiculous that it's hilarious. And I thought, like, there was one of the ones when we were pitching ideas that the Matchbox guys would just be like, no.
Right,
but
because it's not them.
Yeah, but they immediately gravitated to, like, oh, hell yes, this is awesome.
I mean, slightly more seriously, I mean, it obviously is a tricky thing to balance a solo career and a band thing, and there's, like, emotion and ruffled feelings that can result. So, like, what's the trick to that? Because you had a guy leave and come back and the whole thing. I mean, it's like,
yeah, Kyle tough. Took off for a little yeah. while. Yeah. And honestly, for that reason, you know, they wanted to go out one summer and I was out touring with my solo record and it just, I couldn't go out and do the, you know, and it's not like I don't owe them anything. I do, but it just, I had to kind of make that decision. I think we found a really good balance in it now. You know, I think I need to do solo because we're all becoming more collaborative and we write more together. So I write so much that I need another outlet to put things so that I can come in and set my ego and real estate for songs at the door and let everybody kind of participate. And, but we had to go through it like almost therapy style. Like Paul is my best friend in the world. I just had dinner with him like 2 weeks ago when I was in LA and we're talking about the, how's the best way to come about like doing the next thing. But you know, he looked at me and said, and this is him talking, he goes, I really think this is one of the best records you've ever made. If I were you, I wouldn't do another match box record, I would come back and do another solo one back to back.
Wow.
Because he said he thought that it hurt me, my first solo record coming back to Matchbox so soon.
That's really selfish. Yeah.
I thought it was kind of amazing. And I don't know if that's right. I think every time I do a solo record, somebody's like, you know, I think you should do another solo record. And then I do a Matchbox instead. And they're like, oh, you definitely should do another Matchbox record. I just kind of do whatever's there.
I know what he means. So this is a fresh vibe for you. It feels almost like another solo debut because it's a whole other thing for you solo-wise.
Yeah. And I think, you know, everybody now, you know, Kyle's been doing his solo thing. He's got his album Wolves out and his band, you know, they had Rivers and Rust. And he's working in Nashville writing and producing. And Paul has been film scoring for movies and television shows. And now he's been very, very busy doing it to the point where he doesn't have time to do anything. So that makes me really happy that everybody's finding you know, their own thing like I'm finding mine as well.
We were talking about people dying young and mortality. I mean, Gen X, man, has had a hard time of it. I mean, our cultural icons and all sorts of people, just for all sorts of reasons, we seem to be losing them. It's a weird thing.
I don't know that we're getting it harder. I think that it's our turn right now.
Mm.
I think that when our parents, when the baby boomers were going through it and they were losing all these people, it hit them in a very striking way that this is hitting us now because we're losing our own, you know, and especially like Prince. When I think about, you know, like David Bowie was a shared
and he was a boomer, and
Tom Petty was shared,
yeah,
you know, between us and them.
Yeah.
You know, he was around, but he was a little before us, and we stumbled in on that story in the middle, and then we went back and kind of like collected the history of it. But we were, you know, somewhere in the middle on, but like Prince felt like ours. He represented our childhood in so many ways. And I think also there was something important about the grouping, like having so many of the really big ones happened within like 1 year, that made it seem unbelievably eerie. Like there was some sort of selection happening there. But I think that every generation is going to have that. And like, eventually it just gets to be your turn where you start losing. At the end of the day, when you just start seeing people, you know, you start seeing the names on the newspaper or on the TV or on your phone, and the numbers next to those names start getting closer and closer to your number, that's when it really starts to, you start to pay attention in a way. Like if you're sitting in a room and you hear somebody call your name, ears perk up a little more.
So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt, and that was my very entertaining interview with Rob Thomas, who has his new album coming out at the end of April. Mentioned that there is a Funny or Die skit that he and the members of Matchbox 20 did about the song Smooth. And it's funny, of course, because Matchbox 20 was not involved with the song Smooth, but I think they maybe jumped at the chance to mock Smooth, because I'd love to put those guys on a lie detector and ask them about the song Smooth, because they must have complicated feelings about it, I'd imagine. We can actually hear a little bit of this Funny or Die skit.
Man, it's a hot one. I'd say about 7 inches from the midday sun.
I guess this guy couldn't handle the heat.
Word to the wise, when this town gets rough, you gotta stay smooth.
There you go. Maybe look that up. As far as Rob's concerned, that is where the song Smooth and its attending phenomenon hit its apotheosis, so you should definitely check that out. So that was today's show. I should mention that next week I have my first book coming out. It's called Bruce Springsteen, The Stories Behind the Songs, and I've been all over Sirius's other channels. I have a guest DJ spot coming up on E Street Radio that'll air a few times, so maybe look for that. But the book is basically, it's about every single Bruce Springsteen song from every album, and I'd love it if you check it out. Hit me up on Twitter, Hyatt B. Let me know what you think. But again, this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now, and we'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. And maybe leave us a nice review, especially on iTunes. It really helps the rankings there. Or a mildly mean review if you really have to, but leave us a review. And as always, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.